All right, well, we'll get started here. Thank you so much for coming to our Women We Admire presentation. As you know, this is sponsored by the President's Advisory Committee for the Status of Women. I'm Margaret Wu. I'm chair of PACSOF for this current term. It's my great pleasure to introduce our speaker today, Professor Joan Williams from UC Hastings. She is the Distinguished Professor of Law at UC Hastings and also the founding director of the Center for Work-Life Law, and also serves as chair of the UC Hastings Foundation. She has her latest book is What Works for Women at Work, and she has very graciously agreed to sign a personal copy instead of flowers this time. Our raffle gift is going to be an autographed copy of Professor Williams' book, so make sure you stay for that. You must be present to win, so stay for that. But she's been described by the New York Times as having something approaching rock star status among work family advocates. Her article, Deconstructing Gender, which is published in the Michigan Law Review, is one of the most cited law review articles ever published. She's the author of more than 90 academic articles and book chapters that she's written or either co-written. And as we said, her latest book. So with great pleasure that I introduce Professor Joan Williams.
I'm very pleased to be here today. About 5 years ago, I've been working on organizational change and women's issues for pretty much since about 1997. And since 1997, this occurred in terms of the advancement of women in high-quality, high-status jobs. Absolutely fast, by and large. As Sheryl Sandberg pointed out, it's like 14%. You name the industry in high-level jobs, we stalled out at about 14%. And having worked for, you know, over a decade on organizational change, about 5 years ago I said, you know what, I'm like over it. It's not going to happen. It's not happening. I give up. I'm going to write a book about how women can wade through what they find. And that's what this book is. I wrote it with my daughter because I think it's very important that these conversations be cross-generational. The experience of women my age, thank God, despite this depressing stall, is quite different from the experience of women 20, 30 years younger, and that's very much reflected in the book. So a classic study by Catalyst that asks women whether they've encountered gender bias, 96% said yes. And actually, that's 96%, sorry. The classic, a general survey said 68% of women, if you just ask them, have you encountered gender bias, 68% said yes. What I did for this book is I took about 40 years of experimental social psychology studies describing specific patterns of gender bias, and then I interviewed 127 women, I and my team. 60 of them were women of color in STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math. And we asked a very simple question. We just literally recited the findings of the experimental study and then said, any of that sound familiar? Every syllable, said one woman. One woman said, well, a number said, you just described my life. That's a very common reaction. One woman of color, actually, at one of the UCs just burst into tears. All we did is recited the findings of experimental studies, and she just... But one of the value adds, so one of the value adds of this book is these experimental studies, they take place in labs. I actually call them the 40 white college student studies, which is sort of a tongue-in-cheek, but, you know, they're college students. Do you experience X? Give identical resumes, one but not the other, a woman. And then you find very significant differentials. So nobody had ever said, okay, these are lab studies. Do they describe what actually happens at work? That's what this book does for the first time. The answer is yes. 100% of the women of color and 93% of the white women recognize one or more of the patterns. As I always say, as women of color, you have to sing along. We white ladies, very gently. So one of the other value add of this book is that it shows that there are four quite different patterns of gender bias that have different incidence. They also differ in wildly interesting ways by race. I'll be happy to talk about that in the question and answer period. That's actually the report I'm just about about to write with my colleague Kevin Phillips is a study of the women of color in STEM specifically, and we have these dazzlingly fascinating different documentation of the way that women of color experience these patterns differently by race. But I can't crunch all of that into 45 minutes, so I'd be happy to talk about that in the questions. Also, when the race findings are just coming out. They're not even published. So you can see, though, that there are different incidences of these different kinds of bias, and here they are. I'm going to start talking about them one by one. The first is called Prove Again. And consistently we find about two-thirds of women report that they have experienced Prove It Again bias. I'll just give you the example of lawyers, although you can just do it in scientists, doing it silly this week in tech, it's the same difference. You think about the brilliant litigator, you think about the brilliant coder, you think about the brilliant neurologist, most people, the image that jumps into their minds is the image of a man, kind of a tall, white guy, low gray hair. We just don't seem to fit quite as well, and therefore women have to provide more evidence of competence than men in order to be seen as equally competent. Actually, with one study, women and blacks, I think Latinos, same thing, Asians, complicated, super interesting. But women have to provide more evidence of competence than men in order to be seen as equally competent. How does this play out in everyday workplace interactions? That's what this data set shows us. One of the common patterns is that women tend to be judged on their performance, men on their potential. Here's an example. This was from a rainmaker in a professional services firm. I was constantly told, you have the network, but you don't have the work. Whereas a guy could just take clients out golfing or to dinner, that was enough. You notice how he's being judged on his potential, she is not. She's being judged on what she's actually delivered. I don't know if you can see this. It says, it's an excellent suggestion, this trick. Perhaps one of the men here would like to make it. This is what my daughter, Rachel, calls the stolen idea. Anybody ever have this happen to them? Very, very common pattern. It's also a Prove It Again pattern. These patterns, the technical name is stereotype expectancy. You assume that a brilliant idea is going to be coming from a man because the stereotype, so if it's coming, God forbid, from a Latino woman, you know, it's not quite heard often until it's repeated by a man. Women's and men's successes are often understood very differently. The social psychologist called this the he's skilled, she's lucky pattern. It's another stereotype expectancy effect. Similarly with mistakes. Women's mistakes tend to be noticed more and remembered longer. So this is actually from one of the interviews. It was a professional woman saying, you know, if you make a mistake, how quickly do you take her hero robe off? And she was saying much more quickly if she's a woman. This is sometimes called the glass cliff. Here's leniency bias. This is stemmed from in-group favoritism. Leniency bias is that objective rules tend to be applied rigorously to women and leniently to men. Again, this is a racial effect as well, most of these are. So what we find in law firms, for example, nowadays, is when a woman partner loses a major client, her comp is adjusted immediately. Whereas if a man loses a major client, oh, it could happen to anyone, you've got to give them some slack. It's a very, very common effect. This is one of the reasons you see women law firm partners getting de-equitized in higher proportions. That means you were an equity partner, now you aren't. Just put this slide in. This is from a focus group. I think the gender biases work differently for women of color. It's not just heightened for other women. Fascinating topic, report coming up soon. Stay tuned. Okay, so what I did in these interviews, first of all, I said, any of that sound familiar? Those are some of the answers I got. I'm going to go through each of the four patterns. But the other major question we asked was, what strategies have you used or seen others use to help you navigate through this stuff? And so I'm not talking about, in this book, it's basically, what this is experimental social psychology translated into Arabic sociology and written as an advice book. That's what this book is. But I did not focus in the book on institutional solutions. I just talk about on individual strategies. I'm actually now working with tech companies on a new approach to organizational change based on this. But that's I'll say a little bit about that. But I'm going to talk today about the individual strategy. Okay, what if you're sitting in a meeting and people are going through a pile of resumes and it becomes apparent that men are being judged on their potential, women on their performance, or one of these other prove-it-again patterns is emerging, so that there's double standards. You can just say very mildly, you know, I think we finally get what we're looking for in this candidate. So let's go back to the bottom of the pile and just make sure we've picked up everybody who has it. One of the things that we're very focused on, I assembled to help me write this book, a group of wise women, I mean very prominent women, and they often have really feisty strategies. I call them true moxie. The true moxie strategies, they're so much fun, they're not very useful because typically you have to pay too high a political price to use them. So I'm very focused on the mild-mannered strategies, and this is an example of one. How about the stolen idea? You're in a room meeting, a woman said something, a man repeats it as if it's his own idea, and he gets credited for it. Just again, say very mild-mannered, you know, I've been thinking about that ever since Pam first said it. I think it is a great idea, and here's the next step. So you don't have to call anyone out in a harsh way, but you can make sure it's not passed. I was actually giving this talk, and a woman who was on the board of a public corporation where there were only two women said that she and the other woman had begun to do this, and pretty soon the male colleagues were doing it too, and then the next step is it stops, right? If you don't have anybody to do that for you, first of all, shame on you. You don't have the right professional network. But if you have to do it yourself, you can just say again, mild manner, thanks for picking up on that idea. Here's the next step. Now, one of the wise women said, is there an echo in here? Truly delicious, not that useful. If you think about it, if people are going to tend to notice and remember your mistakes and forget your successes, you have to remind them. So it's extremely important to keep careful real-time records of all objective metrics met. This takes some time. It's worth spending the time. And remember, this is a race and gender effect. This is equally important for people of color. What if somebody gives you a compliment? Well, if it's in an email, that's great. You just print it out, put it in your file. If it's not, you can write them a thank you email saying, I was so excited that you gave me this compliment saying X. Thank you so much. That means a lot to me. And then you print out that email. Another important thing is to make sure that you don't do this to yourself. You don't make yourself prove it over and over again. The studies show that if, for example, if there are 9 requirements for promotion, women tend to wait until they have 12. Men go in at 6. And the reason they do is that they're under a lot of gender pressure. They're under gender pressure to show that they are the measure of a man. And that gender pressure for the men gets them over the hump of terror to actually put themselves up. Women, we're not under that gender pressure. We're under the pressure to be modest and self-effacing. So you're going to have to, as a matter of personal will and character, to get over that because the men, you know, the pressures that in many ways are brutal for men do benefit them in this context. Here's an example of organizational change. This is a model, this new model is coming out in Harvard Business Review in October. I call it metrics-driven bias interrupters. The theory is this. If you have a problem in your organization with the advancement of women, you know, God bless Women's Initiative. I'm here today. I think we're very important. I think we're non-responsive. If you have a stall out of women, it's because these kinds of automatic bias are constantly being recreated in everyday workplace interactions and delivered through your business system. So the solution is to change the business system, and that's what I'm working now with tech companies to do. For example, with one, we're going through their performance evaluations to check for the 4 patterns of gender bias. I also did a study with a colleague who's a social psychologist. We read 1,200 performance evaluations of a Wall Street law firm and found, for example, that when women got positive comments, they didn't translate into the global numbers. When men got positive comments, they did. And, of course, Asians were really suitable for backroom work. You'll be astonished to hear. They're very, very open when you begin to read these evaluations, and that's a good example of a bias interrupter. So that's the first type, prove it again. The technical name is descriptive stereotyping. The second type is called prescriptive stereotyping. This is the should. And you can see it was the most common. Almost three-quarters of the women reported it. Now, remember that brilliant neurologist? He's not only male, he's masculine. All high-level jobs are seen as requiring masculine qualities. So women have to behave in masculine ways in order to be taken seriously. Only problem, women are expected to be feminine. And so women find themselves walking a tightrope between being seen as too masculine and so respected for sure, but disliked. Or too feminine, and so light for sure, but not respected. That's the tightrope. Here's an example. Now, when women are in groups of only women, their conversational patterns don't differ from when men are in mixed groups or in groups of men. But when women are in groups with women, they tend to, mixed groups of men and women, they tend to use more tentative forms of speech, don't you think? They tend to interrupt less than the men and to make fewer task suggestions. Don't you think we should do X? That's basically women are sensing that the unspoken messages that they should be behaving in suitably feminine ways and therefore self-editing in a way that makes them less credible. A big, big factor that we're just beginning to name is what my daughter calls the office housework. There are two different kinds of office housework, routine work, and undervalued work. Routine work is, some of it literally housework. For example, have you ever heard of a man who plans an office party? Has there ever been one? I don't know. I don't think so. Everywhere I go, all the women, they're all planning. They're great party planners. Well, gal, if that's your career goal, go for it, girl. I mean, if not, why are you planning this party? Women tend to take the notes. They tend to clean up the debris. They tend to be the ones to make sure there's coffee. Girl, all of that is housework. If you're taking up your time, it's taking up your attention, it is not only not helping your career, it is undercutting your authority. If you want planned parties, plan them for your friends. These parties should be planned by admins. That should be part of their job description. Then there's undervalued work, and undervalued work really differs. One of the things I'm doing now is trying to figure out what this is from profession to profession. And there's actually a box in the HBR article about glamour work versus undervalued work. For example, in architecture, glamour work is making the pitch, visiting the client site, being the lead designer. Housework is designing the elevators and the details on the bathroom, just to give you some sense. It also is a matter of following the money. In investment banking, where they're paid to a percentage of the deal, the housework is working for small clients and small deals. The glamour work is work with large clients and large deals. In litigation, for example, all I have to say is office housework, and women litigators look at each other. At least law firm litigators do, and they look at each other and they go, task list. They all do the task list, right? They do the task list. They organize the discovery. They make sure the document flow is fine. They argue the discovery motion. The men are first chair. They're organizing the non-discovery motions. They are not doing the task list. Office housework is a huge factor in why women are not breaking through that 14% ceiling. So those are all the two feminine problems. And here are the two masculine problems. If you're direct, outspoken, assertive, or competitive, then you're often seen as too masculine, and all of a sudden, your name begins with what?
Yeah.
So if you're stern or you say no, the immediate reaction is to call that woman a bitch, right? If you're a man, it's just a no. This is a formal name for this is attribution bias. But it's basically policing the way women are expected to behave in suitably feminine ways, modest, self-effacing, gentle, quiet. All of those stereotypes are very much with us and have profound effects in many, many workplaces. I sometimes call this the he's assertive, she's aggressive problem.
Anger is a specific challenge for women.
The studies show that open displays of anger increase the perceived status of a man, decrease the perceived status of a woman. And self-promotion is also a key. My husband likes to say that social science documents what every cab driver in New York City already knew, such as people engaged in self-promotion get further than people who don't. Like, who knew, right? But women who engage in self-promotion often encounter pushback. And this can be actually stronger from other women than from men, but it's strong from both. I run a leadership academy for law firm partners. One person was talking about the fact that she found that she was making like $200,000 a year less than her partner, who she thought was very equivalent. And she did exactly what you're supposed to do. She went to the member of a comp committee, and I said, I want to familiarize you with some of my accomplishments in the past year. I brought in this client, and I grew this client. And he looked at her and said, well, you think highly of yourself, don't you? Push back for self-promotion. Okay, here's some tightrope strategies. If you hear these comments, she has sharp elbows, what a witch, she flew off the handle, you can just say very mildly, gosh, I wonder if we would be saying this if this were a man. It's, again, very low-key. How about women... strategies for women themselves. One very important principle is if it ain't broke, don't fix it. I mean, if what you're doing is working, just keep doing it, no problem. But if you people don't seem to be taking you seriously, if you're getting stuck with huge loads of office housework, or if you're getting pushback for having sharp elbows, here are some strategies that you can consider. First of all, with respect to office housework, if it's routine housework, like can you order the coffee? Can you plan the party? Do it graciously and really well once, and then work behind the scenes and establish a rotation. If it's devalued work, then you have to decide, first of all, whether it's important to you. The Women's Initiative, in most environments, is devalued work and very, very time intensive. And a lot of us still do it because it's important. A lot of this work is not unimportant work, it's just devalued work because it's associated with women and femininity. So decide what you're going to do just because it's important, even though it's devalued. But at a certain early point, you have to say, no, I'm not going to do that. I know who's the perfect person for you to do that, and turn down those assignments. That's what we call the strategic no. A lot of women, this becomes even more important when you, in other contexts, for example, a lot of women, they take on sort of scut work assignments, one after the other, and some of these assignments that are not scut work, but are not career enhancing, and then all of a sudden they've taken on so many, the next person asks them, oh my God, I can't take on anything more, I'm so overwhelmed. Does that enhance your authority? No. What you do is you go out, and you get assignments that are actually going to help your career. And you then, when the next opportunity for the paper clip committee comes down the door, you go, that is such an important assignment. But, you know, I'm working on this strategic initiative. I know who's perfect for you. It's Rick down the hall. That's a stretch assignment for them, right? And if you do accept these devalued work assignments, like the Women's or Diversity Initiative, we actually have a checklist for what you do before you say yes. You get a budget. You get administrative help. You get credit for doing it and specific recognition. Otherwise, you are just giving people a free ride in devaluing this work. How about those feminine speech patterns of less, don't you think, what was often called upspeak. Actually, talking to one young woman who went to a coach, and her coach told her that she actually went up twice, once in the middle of her sentence, and one at the end, don't you really think about it? And that was the way she spoke. Actually, the coach told her to stop doing that, and she ended up getting a Ninth Circuit clerkship the next day. The minute she stopped that. These things are very, very, very important. And one of the wise women I talked to said, my mentor taught me how to step on the end of a sentence. If you're having trouble getting a word in edgewise, as soon as someone seems to be sort of puttering down, you jump in and start to talk. And then if he's not finished, you say, oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were wrong. That's what I call gender judo. Doing a masculine thing, interrupting in a feminine way. Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were done. Right? And gender judo is extremely effective in, if you feel pushback, in diffusing pushback. I'll talk more about it for a minute. This is, of course, what Amy Cuddy made famous. I will just ask you, is this a masculine posture or a feminine posture? Is this a masculine posture or a feminine posture? Okay, every primate signals submission by taking up little space and presenting themselves as off balance. That is a submissive posture. We just happen to have linked it with femininity. And so you make the choice. In a meeting where you already feel like you're very threatening, you might want to signal submissiveness. But typically, you don't want to be undercutting your authority just by how you hold your body. This is more gender judo. Every single woman at the CEO level that I talk to, and I talk to a broad range of women, every single one of these CEOs use gender judo. Here's a good example. Be warm, Ms. Mother, 95% of the time. This was a tech exec. So that the 5% of the time when you need to be tough, you can be. Now, I often get a lot of pushback on gender judo. Like, should we have to be doing this? You know what? Isn't this just reinforcing stereotypes? Yes, it is reinforcing stereotypes. But what it's doing in the context where the alternative is pushback is you take that feminine stereotype that typically holds you back and you flip it around to propel you forward. That's the sense in which it's judo. And it can be many different ways. For example, my gender judo, and as you probably noticed, which kind of problems have I had? Too feminine or too masculine? Never had a too feminine problem in my born days. At a certain point, about 10 years ago, I hadn't named it yet, but I basically realized that savvy women use gender judo, and I softened it up. Today I'm dressed kind of butchy, but usually I'm dressed really femme, and I realized that what feels comfortable for me and what I really value about the traditions of femininity is empathy. And I really am fascinated by people, have the ability to make an instant connection with people. So I am direct, authoritative, really bossy, and know my own mind, but I'm very empathetic, right? That's my gender judo. The studies are beginning to come out. We've heard the study, women don't ask, men are 8 times as likely to bargain for starting salary. What you haven't heard is why. Women who do bargain for starting salary tend to be disliked, and people don't want to work with them. It's just prescriptive gender bias. Women are expected to be modest and self-effacing. What are you, some pushy broad, making all these demands? So what the negotiation literature recommends is, surprise, gender judo. You do a masculine thing negotiating, but you do it in a feminine way. Make your request communal. It's really important for my team, what Sheryl Sandberg did. She said this and leaned in. Express concern for relationships. I know this might be upsetting. I really need this raise. I really deserve this raise because of A, B, C metric.
I know this might be disconcerting to Peter. Let's talk about how we can handle that. Like, is this your problem? No, it was Peter's problem. But if you get yourself in a situation where you have triggered backlash, then it's your problem. So, again, doing the masculine thing in the feminine way, my mentor said it was really important that I ask for the raise. Now, again, ladies, should we have to do this? Should we have to be doing this? No, we should not. But, you know, again, you didn't ask me what should work for women at work. This book is about what does work for women at work, and more is the pity. In terms of self-promotion, one very effective strategy is what we call the posse. And that is to form a group of men and women roughly at your level and celebrate each other's accomplishments. Then you're doing a masculine thing, bragging, but in an oh-so-feminine way because you're celebrating somebody else's accomplishment while they're celebrating yours. There's also, the self-promotion literature often also shows for men as well as women, it's more effective to brag to a third party. People dislike you less if you're bragging to a third party, even if they know the third party is being paid to brag for you. That's how strong this is. So form those posses. Also, if you lead a team, one way of bragging is to celebrate your team. I'm going to skip this because we're getting behind. That's an institutional interrupter. I can talk about it later. The third pattern is the maternal lull. 59% of these scientists of color who were moms reported it. And it's really strong. This is the pattern of gender bias that had never been studied before the Center for Work-Life Law, which I direct, organized people to study it. And this is what they found when they studied it. The famous study is Shelley Carrell. Shelley Carrell, they gave people identical resumes, one but not the other, a mother. The only difference was that one mentioned membership in the PTA on the interest section. That difference, it was four words, was enough so that the mothers were 79% less likely to be hired, half as likely to be promoted, offered an average of $11,000 less in salary, these were management consultants, and held to higher performance and punctuality standards. This is proven again by a squared. If you have a negative confidence assumption for a woman, you have a exponential negative confidence assumption for a mother. On the other hand, Shelley Carrell and Steve Fennard did a second study, again an experimental study, where they had a vignette where a mother was indisputably competent and committed and found that those mothers tended to be disliked and they were held to higher performance standards. You can't trust someone who's not a good mother and therefore not a good person, and you don't tend to like her. So this is the tightrope again. Then a very common form of maternal wall bias, which is what we christened this, is the technical name is benevolent prescriptive stereotyping. And actually in the Harvard Business Review article where we talk about this, we quote a graduate student who found out she was not being considered for a major fellowship because she had just had a baby and the man in charge thought it wasn't a good time for her. That is, sends the message, mothers have no business doing this, but in a benevolent way. And sometimes this is absolutely benevolently meant. Okay, so here are some individual strategies. If you hear people saying, remember that time she wasn't here? I have literal quotes in the book of like, yeah, but that was one time. It was 6 years ago, taking my kid to the emergency room. I have been here every other time, and you never noticed. That's all you remember. Notice the attribution. Is she a good mother? We organized another working group to document what's called the flexibility stigma that people encounter if they take parental leave or go part-time, also part of maternal wall bias. Okay, how to intervene. I think it's important to give supervisors a literal script. The woman comes back from maternity leave. This would be a good stretch assignment for her. You don't know if it's a good time for her. You say, you know, you've been doing great work, and this is the logical next step. This is the step for you. And you would be perfect for this, so I wanted to offer it for you. And you know, if it's not a good time for you, not a problem. These things come around a time and again. That's it. I think that many supervisors, women as well as men, are frankly just confused and anxious when they're supervising mothers. And as someone who's run a small organization for 15 years and had, count them, 7 maternity leaves, I can sympathize. I'm also an employer. For women themselves, you need to counter bias with information. So, for example, when you return from maternity leave, you should ask for a meeting with your supervisor and say, I want to familiarize you with my short-term goals in the next year and my long-term goals in the next 5 years. What you're doing is overcoming that descriptive stereotyping with information. If you're willing to travel, say so. If you're the primary earner, say so. If your partner is going to follow you, say so. Because if you don't, the assumptions will be no, that you're not willing to do any of those things. What if somebody says, I don't know how you can work such long hours. My wife could never do that. Leave her kids like that. This is a literal quote from an Asian American lawyer who said, my partner says this to me all the time. The answer is what we call the Tolstoy was wrong answer, if you've read Anna Karenina, Happy families aren't all alike. You know, I'm sure that's right for your family. This is what's right for mine. Again, tongue control is very important. Finally, tug of war. This is when gender bias against women fuels conflict among women. And as you can see, it's the least common type of gender bias. 45% of women, I'm happy to report, have never heard of it. But where it exists, it can be extremely corrosive. So first of all, it doesn't always happen. The older women are have always been very encouraging, very helpful, and very kind. A lot of people said that. On the other hand, here's another quote. Opportunities for women are very zero-sum. If one woman gets a prize position, then another won't. And so it breeds a sense of competition. What this is tokenism giving rise to conflict among ambitious women. This is often called the queen bee, as if this was a personality problem of an individual woman. No, this is just an ambitious woman dealing with the political hand that she's been dealt. Marissa Meyer once famously said, I'm not a girl at Google, I'm a geek at Google. You notice how adeptly she distances herself from the out-group, girl, and she identifies herself with the in-group, geek. There are studies out of the Netherlands that show that women who have encountered discrimination early in their careers tend to do that. They tend to distance themselves from other women. I don't fault Marissa Meyer. I fault discrimination in the environment in which she's navigating. The Kubrick-Yen pass-through often creates conflicts between women professionals and their admins. Here's a good example from that famous study that found that not one legal secretary preferred to work with women partners. Now, 60% didn't care whether it was men or women, but not one preferred women. And here's an example of why. The secretary said female partners are harder on their female assistants, more detail-oriented, and they have to try harder to prove themselves. So they put that on you. In other words, the female lawyer is navigating prove-it-again bias, which is creating conflict with her admin. Also, in terms of admins, and if you have an environment, as law firms, where only 14% of the partners are women, can you fault non-professional women if they prefer to hang their star with a man? I mean, they can do the math, right? Pass-through is also, tightrope is also pass-through. This is actually from a game, an online game I founded called Gender Bias Bingo. I've seen lots of women behave that way. This was a young woman scientist, not only working long hours, but even adopting male mannerisms and being really aggressive. Here's a younger femme criticizing an older tomboy, probably somebody my age. We were all tomboys, by the way, because if we weren't, we would have been housewives. This is an example of what my daughter Rachel calls generational issues. Here's a young woman professor. I'm on kind of a backlash mission. I wear dresses. I bake cookies for my group meetings. I bring my child to class. I'm not going to compete as a boy because I'm not a boy. And women my age can have two reactions. I mean, you know, I'm a feminist, so I look at that and I go, wow, that's great. Women have more cultural room. But the natural reaction is to say, why are you doing it wrong, honey? That's a setup to be shafted, right? And so that's an example of the tightrope pass-through. Women also have a lot of conflict around issues surrounding motherhood. Women my age, for example, why are you taking that long leave? Why are you going part-time? I worked full-time, and my kids are fine, right? These are classic, difficult conversations. Both women's identities are at risk. I'm a good mother. You can't tell me I'm not telling you you're a good mother. I'm just telling you I want to take a 5.5-month leave that I am entitled to under California law. That's all I'm saying. But, you know, what you have is very freighted, difficult conversations that emerge very, very quickly. Also, women who are childless, women who forgot to have children, that means they because of the clockwork of male careers, and all of a sudden they were infertile. Why should you have it all? I had to make such hard choices. Another example of gender bias against women fueling conflict among women. For women who are child-free, I never wanted to have kids. And you're just, all the mommies are reinforcing stereotypes that women, that mothers need special treatment, or the women need special treatment. Very, very common, these mommy wars. Okay, here's some individual strategies. First of all, if there are conflicts among the women, ask yourself, are they a symptom of gender bias? Also, recognize the limits of sisterhood. After all, do men always support men? That doesn't prove they're bitches, right? It just proves they're human. So I think that's an important thing to remember as well. If somebody is undercutting you, it's very important to draw the line. And here is the GC of a very major company who found another woman was like stabbing her in the back behind her back. She had a private meeting, and she said, you know, my sense that I may be wrong here, if you haven't read Difficult Conversations, read it tomorrow. I may be wrong here. My sense is that we haven't always gotten off on the way, the best footing. And my intention is to have a good relationship with you and to be supportive of you. So please, let's have a conversation about how we can turn over a new leaf. Now, that's very artfully framed. If you don't see the art, read Difficult Conversations. She never had another problem with that woman. Women my age need to remember that younger women's experience is simply different. That's what we work for. On the other hand, younger women need to remember that often more senior women aren't helping you as much as you think you should because we don't have the power. I expected in doing this research that gender bias would dissipate for more successful women. Never goes away. That's one of the reasons why a lot of very successful women professionals retire in their 50s. They are just fed up. Also, if you do have these tug-of-war problems, get women working with other women, and not on women's issues, because you'll lose some Marissa Myers. Habitat for Humanity, anything that's not gender differentiated. And my staff would kill me if I didn't put up this slide. We have decided, we founded a membership program called the Women's Leadership Edge in order to provide high-quality, evidence-based content for all of the thousands of women's initiatives. And I look forward to your comments and questions. Thank you.
One of the bias interrupters is where you can redact. Particularly important to redact not only male and female markers, but also markers of motherhood. Very important.
I was interested in your research about, in terms of looking at women of color,
mm-hmm.
and what we were finding was that.
This is so cool. I'm so excited about this. This is so amazing. Now, white tend to stereotype Asian Americans as more feminine than they, and African Americans as more masculine than they. And that's kind of the mainstream.
Nobody knows anything about Latinas. Don't even go there. There's no studies on Latinas. What's the matter? I don't understand. Anyway, but so I'm going to leave them out because I know nothing. Although early indications indicate that they're, in many ways, they're treated more as blacks, similarly to blacks, than to Asian Americans. So Asian Americans, Asians, we all know, they're really passive, right?
Mm-hmm.
Quiet, passive, technical, that kind of what they are. That's the stereotype. And so what we find in, we did both an interview study of these 60 women of color in science, and we did a survey, again, of women scientists, over 500 women of scientists. And what we found in the survey is what I suspected from the interviews, which is for Asian American women, the tightrope is even narrower. The assumption is that you're going to be passive, the China doll, petite, demure, deferential, and so behaving in assertive ways is seen as transgressive much earlier than it is for certainly African American women and even white women. So the tightrope is narrower in the too masculine side. It's also narrower, and you're under more pressures to behave in traditionally feminine ways because everybody knows you're really feminine, right? And so also the Asian American scientists also reported higher levels of agreement with the proposition that I'm expected to play traditionally feminine roles like the dutiful daughter or the office mom. And so that's the scoop for Asian American women. And actually that is an original finding. Nobody's ever said that before. I'm so excited. It's amazing. The configuration, I mean, we all know from intersectionality theory that configuration of gender of bias differs from women of color, but okay, how? That's what I'm trying to answer. For African American women, there's actually a study, one study is proved again, both by Robert Livingston and his colleagues. Proved again study found that that mistakes are even costlier for African American women. Makes perfect sense. They're triggering two sets of negative competency functions. Then there's a study of prescriptive bias, also by Robert and his colleagues, that found that African American women are allowed to behave in more dominant ways than white women before they encounter pushback. In general, the tightrope appears to be broader for the African American women than for the other three groups of women. They were much less likely to report pushback for being assertive, and they were much less likely to report that they were expected to play traditional feminine roles. Part of this is, you know, there's a cultural tradition of not putting up with any of that, and I think people are frightened to insist on that. Robert on the finding that African American women are allowed to behave in more dominant ways. I think it's true, but I also think it's complicated. I have a lot of evidence from the interviews of African American women saying, in effect, "Bitch, oh yeah, it works for me. It's pretty good." On the other hand, at a certain point, you're an angry black woman, and then watch out. So I'm not really sure what the configuration is. There's literally two studies, all of this, two experimental studies about how the experience of gender bias differs by race, only two, both by Roberts, both comparing African Americans to whites. So very early days, but those are some of the findings.
Just a side question when you study the ascription of intelligence applied.
That's the prude again.
Is there a difference between African American women and Asian women?
Oh, I assume there is. You know, everybody knows Asians are smart, right?
These stereotypes, they're not talked about in polite company, but boy, are they strong.
I'm about a conversation killer. Sorry. Didn't say it.
Yeah. I'm curious if any of the strategies you give in your book are different by generations of men, because I know when I worked in the law world, dealing with someone who was 70 and his perception of women was very different from dealing with someone who was 30, for example.
We didn't go there. I focused on different generations of women because this is really what women experience and advice for women. I do think there are differences among, very important generational differences among men. One thing I will say, though, is that men since the 1980s have said they wanted to spend more time with their families. And there's a much higher level. The general pattern, it appears to be shifting, it's a complicated topic, is that upper middle class men talk the talk of gender equality, but not necessarily walk the walk. Working class men generally walk the walk of gender equality, but they don't talk the talk. So it's very, very complicated. But you'll certainly see very high levels, much higher levels among younger men of embracing of being a feminist. What that means, though, is often very complicated, much more complicated than the men themselves are aware of. Oh, a quiet group. Yeah.
When you're working with the tech companies as you are, who initiated that? Was it the women executives? Were there allies among the men executives? How did you break into that institutional change?
Probably don't want to go there. Suffice it to say, I mean, Google released its metrics, right? I think that was a very brave thing to do. And so I was very eager after that to work with the tech companies because sort of the diversity industrial complex is designed to deliver what sociologists call symbolic compliance. That is not very threatening. But once you've released your metrics, symbolic compliance is not going to work because it doesn't work. And they need to show increasing improvement in the metrics. So that's why I'm very interested in working with tech because I want, I mean, just an example of a metric is a very common pattern in law firms is that the partners, 86% of them white men, tend to refer business to other white men. So that pattern of in-group favoritism, internal referral. So the metric would be survey the department, men as well as women, and find out how they're getting their work. If there is a pattern of white male to white male referral, then you actually have some data to go and talk to people about it. Then you implement an interrupter, which could be a bias training, see if that works. Maybe. And if that doesn't work, then you ratchet up into more more intrusive interrupters. That's the idea. And the idea is to set up an organizational change process that is evidence-driven and iterative, so it's perfectly designed for tech. It's also perfectly designed, I hope, for being effective. So wish me luck.